Welcome to Pardes Daily, where you get your daily dose of Torah with Pardes faculty. This month, Pardes is bringing Elul to you. Let's dive in.
Hi, this is Rachel Berkovitz coming to you from Jerusalem. This is Unit 15 of 20, in which we're learning through all the Mishnayot of Masechet Rosh Hashanah. Right now, we're at the very end of the third chapter, and we need to finish off the chapter today and say something about the whole entire chapter. Okay. When we say something about the chapter, we're going to connect to those Agadic stories, but I want to start by reading the last snippet of the last Mishnah, which I told you in the manuscript stands on its own, but here in our printed versions is part of the last Mishnah. And it really seems like an addendum tacked on and has some awkwardness to it, as I explained, that we need to sort of unpack and understand. The text says the following. I'm at the very end of Mishnah Chet, of Mishnah 8. Cheresh shota v'katan, ein motzin et harabim yidei chavotan. A deaf mute, someone who is unable to hear and unable to talk due to a link between those two things. Obviously, nowadays we know that people who are hearing impaired can also speak. And those two things are not listed, but this is the rabbis talking in the beginning of the turn of the century, around the year 0 to 200. Shota, someone who is intellectually disabled, who is other-abled intellectually. The katan, and a minor, someone who is under the age of maturity. Technically, we say 12 for a girl, 13 for a boy. We're going to talk about these three people, why they're grouped together in a moment. But these three people, types of people, it's not individual people, ein motzi'im et harabim yidei chavotan. They do not fulfill the obligation of the many, right? Ein motzi'im, they do not fulfill the many, their obligation. Zeh haklal. This is the rule. Anyone who is not, and in the manuscripts it says chayab b'davar, obligated in the thing, in the act, does not fulfill for the many their obligation. Now, there is a lot to say about this. Which obligation are we talking about? Presumably, we're talking about shofar, because we're in the context where we've talked about shofar. Although the text doesn't specifically say shofar. And in fact, this general rule that anyone who is not obligated in an act cannot fulfill it on the behalf of the many, this is a rule that works for all mitzvah performance and is very, very important basic rule of understanding, can one person act on behalf of a group to perform mitzvah actions. And this is the place where we get taught this rule. So, and as it said, Zahaklal, this is the general rule. So that's interesting. And the terminology is also interesting how it gets portrayed, right? It says Cheresh v'katan can't fulfill on behalf of the many, because the rule is anyone who's not obligated. And then, so we only find out in a backhanded way that apparently Cheresh v'katan aren't obligated in whatever we're talking about. Let's presume it's shofar, but I still find it interesting that's not mentioned specifically. We find out in a backhanded way through their relationship to the community, we find out about their individual status, as opposed they could have opened by saying that they're exempt, right? Or that if they were wanting to say they're up, like we could have focused on them first, but we sort of focus on their individual's relationship to the community. And I think this is going to be one of the main themes of this chapter, to find out that they're exempt. Okay. Why are they exempt? The text doesn't explicitly tell us, but I think it gives us enough information for us to think about this. The rabbis like to link together groups of people that have similar halachic legal standing. And the grouping of Cheresh Shota V'Katan goes together a lot. Not everyone is always in only one group. Ketanim, as you'll see, are in another group as well. Minors appear in more than one group. But what unite, and they put them together because there's some unifying basic fact that functions the same way throughout the group. And it seems to be the reason that these three types of people are put together is there is an assumption. I think Shota is the person who sort of represents the group in the most clear way, that these people have an intellectual disability, that their intellectual capabilities are lacking in some way. The minor, because of their age, they're not fully mature, and therefore their brain, or I want to say their lev, their heart, right? Because the rabbis don't have a sense of a brain. It's in their lev, as we talked about, in their heart, is not mature due to age. The shote, for whatever reason, due to something that happened at birth or some type of injury, has had damage to their intellectual capabilities. And the cheresh, as I said, unfortunately, in those days and the day and age that we're talking about, because there was a lack of communication, people didn't understand what was going on in their brain. And the assumption was that they also lacked some intellectual capabilities. And so these three are put together because of that unifying factor. Now, this directly fits, interestingly enough, to the flow of our chapter, because our chapter has just informed us that there's some concept when performing mitzvot called kavanah, right? Kavanah talev. And that minimally, from a legal perspective, I need to have a basic understanding that the act I'm doing is an act of a mitzvah. And then maximally, that I learned from the stories about Moshe's hands and about the snake, that this will lead to a kavanah talev that transcends that is an internal spiritual connector to the divine, right? And that somehow mitzvah performance has both of these levels to it. We're going to come back to this idea and flesh it out even more. And so then I understand in that context, I understand after this discussion about kavanah talev that people who have a lev that isn't does not function in a manner that may not be able to grasp either of those levels, right? I think that a minor is a good example, meaning a very young minor might not understand that there's a mitzvah action that I need to do, or I need to just like focus. Even as mine is mature, the capability of grasping that the act links one to something greater than oneself, to the divine, is something that one needs a mature mind, dat, cognizance, lev, kavanah, to understand. And so this category of people is not required to do this act, right? This, I think, the concept of being not obligated here is a sympathetic act of understanding the reality of human situation and not requiring someone to do something that they are going to be incapable of doing, right? If I require you to do an action you're incapable of doing, and then I'm going to hold you responsible and it's going to have negative consequences, right? Thinking back to Rosh Hashanah being a day of judgment, right? And we saw in the first chapter linked to the God knowing your lev. I hadn't actually even thought of that, right? That pasuk at the beginning of the first chapter, right, was Yotzer Yachad Libam, that the divine created together their hearts, their minds, Hamevin El Kol Ma'asehem, and therefore knows everything about their actions, right? And clearly this chapter is continuing that theme. I hadn't really thought of it that way, because we're talking about the consciousness human beings have about their actions. And we talked in the first chapter that those actions are going to link to how the divine is going to judge the world and think about the world and human beings. And here too, we have seemingly the same idea, and understanding that because the divine understands human heart and human actions, these people must be exempt, because the divine is not going to hold them responsible for not doing the appropriate action. Okay. One other thing I want to say about this, about this section here is, I think I've mentioned to you a few times that you could compare our chapter of the Mishnah to the chapter of the Tosefta, the additional Tanaitic material on these topics. And I had mentioned that there is in the Tosefta, it talks about who's obligated in the act and who isn't. And it appears much earlier in the chapter where the focus seems to really be on the individual. And we suggested that one of the reasons that it got moved, I think, is because the focus is less on the blower and more on the hearer. But second of all, I think another reason it's moved here is now we can understand the exemption and obligation of performing mitzvot much more in the context of understanding the need for a lave, that there is a link between your cognizance and your action, like we saw in the first chapter with the verse. But what the other interesting thing is, if you look in the Tosefta about who is obligated and who isn't, there it's definitely talking about shofar. It says hakol chayvim b'shofar. Everyone is obligated in shofar. And after it says everyone is obligated, it gives a whole long list. It says Kohen Yisrael, Kohen Levi v'Yisrael, priests and Levites and Israelites. And then it lists all types of men. And it actually has a different, it doesn't mention Cheir Shotev HaKatan. It doesn't mention the three here. It mentions a different three pairing. And it says that Nashim Avadim Uktanim, women, slaves, and minors, are exempt from shofar blowing. And it says it explicitly in the Tosefta. And I would actually like to suggest, this is not how it develops in rabbinic literature, and it does not, what I'm about to say is not how the halakha goes. The halakha actually goes like the Tosefta, that women are exempt from shofar blowing because that Tosefta gets quoted in the Babylonian Talmud. But I would actually like to suggest the opposite, that our Mishnah here is actually choosing, and we saw the edited hand of the editor, how carefully he chose to formulate the Mishnah different than the structure of the Tosefta, and seems to know the Tosefta. I would like to argue that the editor of the Mishnah is saying dafka the opposite. If the only people are Cheresheta and Katan, who cannot fulfill it on behalf of the Memi because they lack cognizance, right? That's the main issue about shofar, right? It doesn't matter who you are. A lot of scholars, I think I've mentioned this before, talked about that in the Mikdash, in the temple, the shofar blowing was linked to the Kohanim, and this was an elite ritual that not everyone could partake in. And we saw in the first chapter a similar idea that the Kohanim wanted to be more exclusive about who could do Kiddush HaChodesh, and that the rabbis, part of their agenda, particularly post-temple, is to widen the sphere of people who can create holiness in this world and can be the ones who are performers of ritual. I would actually like to argue that what is being said here is that the only defining factor for if you can fulfill the act on the many, for the many, is your capability of your lave and understanding the act and understanding the connection to the divine. And that is the only thing that that seems to take you out of the category of obligation. At least this text does not explicitly say that women are exempt from shofar blowing. And the Tosefta that links women, slaves, and minors together and makes them exempt, why are women, slaves, and minors together? That's something about their social status. All of them are in the domain of someone else. They're not free functioning agents. Women in the domain of their husband or their father, slaves in the domain of their master, children here again in a different side of them in the domain of their father. And something about their social status, right? And there that text is talking about social status. Exempts them. That seems to be not the message that our text here in the Mishnah wants to suggest, right? And we particularly learned in the second chapter that we identify women, they can be a chachama, right? The midwife can have serious knowledge and intellect and bring life into this world. Clearly does not fall into the category of Cheres Shotev HaKatan, right? Someone like that clearly knows the intentions of actions and how the impact actions have on the world, and can clearly link to the divine. So I would like to suggest that the pshat of the Mishnah, not how rabbinic Judaism goes on here, is a much more widening of the net of who is capable of blowing the shofar and being the vessel to which the rabbim, to which the many, can fulfill their linkage to the divine. So that's my suggestion here at the end. This link between the individual and the many, I think, is a theme that runs throughout the chapter. First of all, I'm just going to say that the end of the fourth chapter that we're going to start learning next week also ends on the with this question of the link between the individual to the many and fulfilling the obligation of the many. So we once again have a beautiful structure ending that's going to link linguistically to the structure ending of the Mishnah. But I would now want to say something about the, in my last few minutes, about the whole chapter. And I see this theme about the individual and the many. I saw this already in the first Mishnah. Remember when the Beit Din and Kol Yisrael, right, when the whole nation saw the moon and therefore are creating sanctity. And that was the opening to the first Mishnah. And the ending of the first Mishnah was that the individual cannot act alone, right? We can't have one single judge. He has to be joined with his friends. And so that Mishnah and the whole mitzvah of Kiddush HaChodesh, right, which we saw for the first two chapters, is something about the responsibility of the entire nation, of the Am, coming together, right? Yes, they're individuals acting. They're the individual witnesses and the individual judges, but they are representative of Kol Yisrael, of the whole nation. And the message was very clearly that the individual cannot act alone. And running throughout the whole chapter, I think we see this idea of the nation as one, right? The nation doing battle with Amalek, the nation holding communal fasts when there is no rain, right? The lack of rain affects me as an individual, but I band together with the entire community, because maybe linked to that second mission in the first chapter of knowing that the whole world is judged as one, we're judged as a group about rain. The image of Yovel, of the Jubilee, which is a communal, of, you know, a national social responsibility that I have to individuals, but it's about creating a society as a whole that I want to live in as a nation, and that everyone in the society is on the same timetable and behaves in the same way. I think we see the imagery of the temple. We saw the shofar and the chatzotrot being blown in the temple. And we had then the image of the Beit Knesset as another communal institution, right? The temple itself is, you know, Kohanim, our communal representatives acting on behalf of the nation. The Beit Knesset, where Knesset, I come together as a nation. Even the Beit Din that we have is as a representative of the whole, of the, you know, of the governing body of the nation. And so running throughout, we have the behaviors of the nation as a whole. We even had the mention of the Megillah. I don't know if you remember, it was like a side, throw it out, right? If you're passing by a synagogue and you hear shofar, you hear the voice of the Megillah. Well, what's the voice of the Megillah? The voice of the Megillah is telling us our communal history, telling us a story of what happened to our ancestors and to us as the Jewish people, right? So there is also the image of the nation. And this idea of wholeness, we also saw in the body of the shofar itself, right? We wanted an integrity. We don't want it to be broken. We don't want it to be in pieces. We don't want it to have holes. And the shofar itself had this wholeness to it. And that transferred also into a desire for the complete, a complete and whole sound. And so this image of that individuals don't stand on their own, that there's some very strong importance to being part of a nation, being part of a community, came through loud and clear in our Mishnah. On the other hand, there was a bit of a voice saying the opposite. When we got to Mishnah 6 and 7, we suddenly realized, obviously, that there are individuals. Up until now, there really hadn't been individuals. You know, the shofar was getting blown in the temple, and I told you it's a Kohen doing it, but I don't know who was doing it. The Jewish people as a collective were fighting a battle. And we knew that the Beit Din of three was like, at the end of the second chapter, was like Moshe's Beit Din, but didn't have individuals singled out. The names weren't mentioned. And then we see that they're individuals, right? The tokeya latoch habor, the one who's blowing into a cistern, that sounds like a situation where someone is quite alone. And it's that person who's blowing is also hearing, right? He seems to be blowing for himself. And then we had Misha Haya Over, the one who passed behind the Beit Knesset, right? There too, a one, right? Everyone seems to be in shul, and that person's apart from the shul. They're passing by. And then we had another line, not just the one passing by, but one who's the Mishnah said, the one whose home is, where's the exact line? It says, Shahaya Beito Samuch LeBeit HaKnesset, that his home was connected to the Beit HaKnesset. And that sentence, I like that juxtaposition between Beito, his home, and the Beit of the house where everyone comes together, right? There's the individual's home that is next to it, but separate from the other home in which the entire community comes together. And so we see that that there's an individual that is separate from the whole in some way and is distinct from the whole. And the text wants to tell us also, how does that individual fulfill their obligation? Right. And we were told that it's about the in kivein libo, his personal heart. Right. If he does something with his own personal direct, his own personal heart, then he has successfully done something on an individual level. And that brought us to these beautiful agadot of Moshe raising his hand and of the serpent. And we saw there, too, there was a play like the battle was about the success of the entire nation of Israel, whereas the individual who needed healing from the snake bite was a specific person. Will this person live or will this person die? And it seems to me that the question is, like, what is this experience of shofar? Is it something that's solely communal, or is it something that is specifically linked to the individual? And I think that the end of the chapter speaks right to that message, that somehow the individual's obligation and the individual below her then affects the community. And there's some link between the individual, the yachid and the rabim, the individual and the rabim, the many. Another level here that I think that ties into this that we saw throughout the chapter is the kol shofar, the voice of the shofar, right? That the shofar has a voice on its own. Right. There is a blower, and that blower is important, but the blower's job is to create that, to give voice to the shofar. And that shofar has a sound that like reverberates out or reflects out, right? We saw that with the concept of that it can even echo, and that it carries, that sound carries. Someone can walk behind a shul and hear it. And it calls out to people. And we know that it rallies people in war. And in some ways, it can be a connector of people, right? I'm inside the shul and someone's outside and they hear the same noise as me. And if I'm concentrating inside the shul and that person's concentrating outside, it connects them. And there is some sense of communal linking, even though we're individuals that are separated. And the sound and hearing that same sound is what's connecting us. And the question I think that's being presented here in some ways is, what is this calling of the shofar? What is this rallying of the shofar on Rosh Hashanah supposed to be for us? What are we supposed to be thinking about when we hear it? And I think that there, that the agadot that we read can imbue some meaning for us. What's interesting about the story of Moshe's hands and the snake, it teaches us, those both stories teach us that intermediate vessels can spur us to like conscious and intentional action, that there's some positive vessel in between that can spur us to action, and that's of value. And I think that the shofar seems to be that vessel. We spend so much time talking about what it looks like and what it's made of, and that it's some in vessel. And what's interesting about it, we talked a lot about its shape, and the shape could be meaningful if it was kafuf, if it was on a fast day like humbling. But no matter, even if it's twisted or bent, when you blow it, it goes upwards. It points upwards, and the sound thing has to be coming up, I think. I don't think, would it be impossible to blow it downwards? I don't know. It has to be, it's directing upward. And just like Moshe's hands are directing upward, and just like the snake on the stick is directed upward, and just like Kiddush HaChodesh, sanctifying the moon, like looking for the moon, directs our thoughts upward. And as we saw from the stories, right, that the purpose was to have humans actively connect to the divine, that they should see Avihim Shebashamayim. Right, that should create some active connection. And I think that this is really interesting because we have at the beginning of the chapter an emphasis on the word mikudash, 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 right? A few times it gets repeated at the beginning of this chapter. 1, 2, 3, 4 or 5 times in that first Mishnah, human beings create sanctity by looking at the moon and creating sanctity of time based on what happens in the Shamayim, right? And what happens in the sky. And that's juxtaposed to a different Mikdash that we haven't heard the word of. We're going to hear it at the beginning of the fourth chapter, of where God resides on earth in the temple. Right. But unfortunately, we're in a time period where the temple has been destroyed. We know that already from the first chapter. And we're going to hear it again in the fourth chapter. And yet we are told that there's some sanctity in Shamayim, that the divine also exists within Shamayim. Right. That obviously, I think colloquially, we talk about God being in heaven. But there is definitely in rabbinic thought some juxtaposition between the divine that resides in sanctity in the temple in this world and a divine that doesn't post-destruction. And where does the divine reside? The divine resides in the sky, and we see it in the moon. And that somehow the cry of the shofar directs our hearts upwards to Shamayim and possibly helps us remember that we are indebted for the water that we receive and for the good crops that we receive, as we saw in the first chapter, to the provider and the creator of the world. So on this day, Rosh Hashanah, in which the world is created, right? We learned that in the first chapter with that verse of creating, that God created human beings live together. We sort of direct consciously once a year, point ourselves upward to remember this fact. I also was thinking of that God judging the Jewish people or all human beings like the Kenumeron, right? Like the Roman army, and the shofar being like heralding the army in battles. We saw that theme here again. And so I know I'm talking a long time. I'm almost finished. What is also interesting to me is that the shofar in some ways becomes a model for all mitzvot. Like it's a mitzvah action that one is required to do, but it becomes like a model for all mitzvah actions because it's a mitzvah action that its whole purpose is to direct us upwards and to think about connecting to the divine and I think connecting to the people surrounding us. And our connection as what it means to be an individual, that's part of an entire nation, and how I'm connected to the nation and my fate of the nation and my personal fate is tied to the fate of the nation and also is tied to my personal interactions as an individual and the unique individual that I am. And that possibly part of the message is that all mitzvot are like that, that all mitzvot connect me both to the divine and to others, both as an individual and part of a whole. So I hope that gave you a deeper understanding, a little bit of shofar. We're not done with shofar. It's going to continue in the fourth chapter. And when we blow it on Rosh Hashanah, that seems to be heralding, like the Jubilee year, something about how we relate to other people and how we treat other people, which is linked to our understanding that the divine is the creator of the world and ultimately that all human beings are created in the image of the divine. I hope that unpacking this chapter will bring you more meaning on Rosh Hashanah. But we're not done with the shofar. We have the fourth chapter to learn next week, and we'll then be done with the entire chapter, the entire tractate. And there we're also going to see a link between Mikdash and post-Mikdash and shofar. Shabbat Shalom.
Thank you to our Pardes faculty, and thank you to you, our learners. Make sure to check back in at the beginning of each week to stay on track with your Elul learning. And visit www.pardes.org.il for more information about Pardes and our programs.